Morning, everyone. Today is April 20th. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee meeting. We do have a quorum. I will ask Representative Agbaje if she's had a chance to review the minutes of our last meeting.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
She has, and she moves the minutes be approved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Members, we do have a very busy agenda today. I have to make a few opening remarks, though. I spent most of the weekend on the telephone for a variety of reasons from both sides, frankly. I'm just going to remind folks that this is not the final stop for bills. Once they're out of Ways and Means, they go to the House floor, but they can be amended on the floor. Most of these bills are probably not going to agree perfectly with the Senate. There will be conversations with the Senate where things can also be repaired if repair work is necessary. Funding issues are going to probably change by the time we see the final bills that we pass at the very end of session, because, again, we have to work with the Senate to really identify exactly how all these issues are funded. What I'm saying is we have a lot of work to do. I'm hoping we can move bills. If there's serious issues, we will hold them up, of course. But if they're minor issues that can be repaired through the process, please consider that we have a lot of work to do and plenty of opportunities to do the repair work necessary. With that reminder in place, we will bring up the first bill. It's a Bennett bill, House File 3489. I will move your bill, Representative Bennett, to be referred to the General Register. Representative Bennett, as soon as you're ready, please identify yourself and present your bill. Yes, we do have an amendment to this bill. I will move the A6 amendment. Representative Bennett, would you please tell us about the A6 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Peggy Bennett, District 23A. And this just says the fiscal appropriations for the bill, the amendment.
Thank you. Any questions regarding the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All those in favor of the A6, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Your amendment is adopted. Representative Bennett, please give us a brief description of your bill. And I see you have a couple testifiers. I assume you're going to go first.
I do have a couple of testifiers, Mr. Chair. I will go first, and thank you so much, committee and chairs, for hearing this bill. I'd like to just briefly tell you how this came to be in the first place. This last fall, reporter Jennifer Merrily reached out sent an email out to a bunch of legislators asking for comments on a story she was doing, a series on the sexual grooming of children in schools. And evidently, I was the only one who responded to that. I don't think it was by accident either, because when I spoke with Jennifer, learned about Hannah, who's going to testify in just a minute, who was sexually groomed, and I learned during my discussion with Jennifer by her band director, she's a percussionist, and it really brought back memories for me from quite a few years ago before Hannah was even born. But when I was a 10th grader in high school, I was groomed by my band director, and I was a percussionist. And I just thought, you know what? I think it's time I tell my story, too, because I really haven't shared it with many people, even as an adult. Only family and very close friends know about it. I came close to being raped by my band director. And so here I hear this happening a generation later, and I'm thinking, I need to share also. If Hannah's brave enough to do it, I will be as well. And we need to get this done. And so that's how this bill came into being. I met Hannah. She's very organized. I met Detective Chad here from the Eagan Police Department. And we came up with this bill. And what it does, and it's been through many committees, had great support, it strengthens protections for students against sexual grooming. It has clear field trip supervision rules, which we have change so that it's not evident. The school doesn't have to have two staff, but it talks about being alone with a student, that a staff person or someone in charge. And so we've cleared that up a little bit. creates a new felony offense for child grooming and improves mandatory reporting to include grooming and enhances training to include grooming. So, Mr. Chair, I really think my testifiers can flesh this out much better. So if we could start with Hannah, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Hannah Lopresto. I'm a victim survivor of grooming and sexual assault by my high school band teacher when I was a student from 2012 to 2016 at Egan High School. Co-chairs Torkelson and Frazier and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3489. As a high schooler, I played percussion and had the same band teacher each year. Early on, this teacher made me feel special by asking me to help him organize music or move instruments after class. Over the course of the 4 years, he slowly began to isolate me from friends and family, normalize touching me and communicating as if we were close friends. On an international band trip to Greece, this escalated to him showing a romantic interest in me, manipulating seating charts so I was always next to him on the airplane, pulling me away from the group on tours, and slipping a secret note in my suitcase. Back at school, he used religion as a form of control, stating that God put me in his life for a reason and made me believe that I had to marry him because of the things I had done. On the morning of my last day of high school, he sexually assaulted me in the band lesson room. He put his hands down the back of my pants and the front of my shirt. I froze and I cried. That same day, he sent me a photograph of a handwritten note saying, "My love for you will always exist. It will last forever." I graduated the next day, and the sexual abuse continued into my early college years. Due to the years of grooming, I believed that I was an active participant in my abuse and that I had caused it to happen. I did not tell anyone the full story until Detective Chad Clausen from the Egan Police Department found me in 2022 during a separate investigation into the same teacher's misconduct on a band trip 6 years after mine. I learned that I wasn't the first victim and I wasn't the last. I couldn't come forward with my story until I knew there were others, because this teacher made me believe that I was so special that this could never have happened to anyone but me. Often when I share that I was groomed and sexually assaulted, most people focus in on the sexual assaults as being the most horrific and impactful. But for me, the 5+ years of grooming were even more harmful to my long-term health and well-being. It was half a decade of psychological manipulation that harmed my understanding of healthy relationships, my own value, and my ability to trust others. Grooming is not just a precursor to abuse, it is abuse all on its own. I'm not a researcher or a scientist, but I need to share an observation about the prevalence of grooming. Just in the time that I've been here, participating in the legislative session, I've had people at every turn, during meetings, after presentations, and even in committee hearings like this one, disclose that they or someone they love has experienced grooming too. What happened to me is not as rare as I once thought. Grooming made me feel alone, a one of one that nobody could truly understand. But I was wrong. There are victim survivors all around us. There are neighbors, our friends, our colleagues, our representatives, our family, our students, and our children. You may not often see us, but we're here, and we need your support greatly. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your bravery. We have another testifier. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Chad Clausen. I'm a detective with the Egan Police Department. Co-chairs Torkelson and Frazier, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3489. I'm the detective who investigated Hannah's case. Although there were no criminal charges, that outcome was not due to a lack of probable cause. It was due to gaps in Minnesota laws in 2016. Some of those gaps were addressed in 2021, but others remain, many of which are included in this bill. The only reason we are here today is because of the courage of Hannah. This bill focuses on Hannah's story, and every day we learn that Hannah is not alone with her experiences. Grooming can be a concept that is difficult to define, but that does not mean we should not define it. When some elements of grooming can look like a benign, caring relationship, investigating and charging these cases can be challenging, but it can and has been done. grooming a minor with the intent to sexually abuse them has already been established as a felony in 18 states. We need teachers to care about their students and go the extra mile. This is not grooming. Honest, professional relationships are essential. Grooming is always intentional. You cannot accidentally groom a child. Grooming is the deliberate process of building a false sense of trust with the child to make future sexual abuse easier. Delayed disclosure is common in grooming and child sexual abuse cases, and this was true with Hannah. I first interviewed Hannah in April of 2022, nearly 6 years after she graduated high school. At the same time, MDE was investigating this teacher's inappropriate relationships with different students. Presently, MDE cannot investigate maltreatment older than 3 years. In the criminal investigation, I observed a clear playbook used to groom multiple students. The volume and content of communication was alarming, with repeated phrases, themes, and tactics used to manipulate and control multiple students. While I determined there was probable cause that this teacher sexually assaulted Hannah on school property, MDE could not conclude that maltreatment occurred. This resulted in the teacher maintaining a valid teacher's license at the conclusion of both the criminal and MDE investigations. Under current law, even a third grader who disclosed sexual abuse from their kindergarten years would be excluded from an MDE investigation. When MDE cannot investigate incidences older than 3 years, this allows for predators to remain in the classroom. A teacher cannot accidentally groom a student. It is not a one-time event. Grooming is a process committed over years and can take just as long or longer for survivors to disclose. This bill not only establishes grooming as a felony offense, but it also works to prevent it from happening in the first place. We are here because if Hannah is willing to be vulnerable and trust us with her story so that it may be used to protect our children from future sexual abuse. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I will turn to fiscal staff for a review of the fiscal aspects of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the A6 amendment reflects an appropriation that is that was deemed necessary by both the Department of Education for additional staff to implement the bill language. So this is $1.451 million in fiscal year 27, and then ongoing amounts that are similar. And then the Department of Corrections, pardon me, also has an appropriation in the case that there would be additional beds required for convictions that were found. So this would be $13,000 in fiscal year 28 and then $35,000 in fiscal year 29. And, Mr. Chair, if there are additional questions about the fiscal note, we have fiscal staff here who know a little bit more about this than I do.
Thank you for that information. We have a question from Representative Uwakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Chair Bennett for bringing this bill forward. I want to thank you, and I want to thank Representative Liz Ryer, who started this out the year before. I think a lot of folks have worked on this. We didn't have the fiscal note in education finance when we saw this bill before, so I just have a few quick questions. I didn't know if anybody from MDE was here or if I could direct it to fiscal staff instead.
All right. We do have somebody from MDE. If you'd please step forward to the testifying table. Please identify yourself for the record, and then we'll go to the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you. Representative Uwakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the latitude. These are kind of the same questions I would have asked if we had the fiscal note in front of us in Ed Finance. And I was remiss without thanking Ms. Lopresto for being so brave to testify in so many committees along the way. Mr. Uni, I was just wondering, I understand the fiscal note, and I want to thank Chair Bennett for actually putting appropriations in to kind of match up with the fiscal note. Hopefully they're ongoing. I know it's hard to hire staff and then have to let them go if it's one-time money. But my question really is, like, is there a way, because this is a lot of money when we're looking at other school safety issues that we want to deal with. In fact, I think this would be a great basis for a complete package of a school safety bill. But with a three-year look back, how much of the fiscal note is that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Chair Youakim, if you look on page 5 of the fiscal note, we do a breakdown of the FTE needs for what is in the proposal. If you look at the 5.5 investigative staff impacts, 1.7 is required for the increased complexity of the sexual abuse caseload. 24 is required for new grooming-related cases with the new definition. And then 1.4 we've identified as the FTE need to handle the extension from the current three-year statute of limitations on our look-back.
Follow-up, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can't do math in my head that fast, but if I'm trying to remember right, average FTE is how much?
Mr. Yuni.
Madam Chair, you're referring to the actual amount per staff member?
Yes.
For these investigators, I don't have that memorized. I know our screening intake FTE, if you look on page 6, is 185,122. So I believe it's probably around there. I can't do the math very quickly. I don't have that memorized. My apologies.
Another follow-up, Representative Walking?
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Uni. No, I think, like I said before, this is a really great basis for a full school safety package because this does have to deal with our student safety when they're in the schools. So I hope our committee will consider that as the bill moves forward. I still want to dig into the fiscal note a little bit more and figure out a way we can maybe trim some of that. But are you confident, Mr. Uni, that you'll have enough funds? I know having investigators take longer can really traumatize students even more. Are you confident that the money will be there past this fiscal note horizon for you to do the work that's needed?
Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair Youakim, if the bill has the funding for an ongoing basis, you would have the required FTEs to do this. I think one of the reasons I think on our end the fiscal note took a while is because our team went to great lengths to do nationwide research on jurisdictions that do have resources to target this type of, to target grooming specifically. And we know that the best practice research, which we put into the fiscal note, says around 30 caseloads. And if this funding is adequate to get us down, and I believe it is, to get us down to 30 caseloads, that is something that will be critical to, as you pointed out, not continue to re-victimize our children who are the subject of part of these investigations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the latitude.
Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair. Further testifier from Department of Education. Are any of your current investigators or any of the investigators that you would hire if this bill were to pass and you were to get the funding, would they be sworn licensed officers in the state?
Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozik, that's a good question. I haven't looked into that in terms of sworn officers of what they would be. They would be part of our student maltreatment program. Many of those are attorneys who are investigating these. It depends on which staff members there are. There are intake investigators. We do have a screening intake staff and supervisor. In terms of sworn officers, let me ask a question just to clarify. Do you mean like a law enforcement officer?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it could be that someone who qualifies for this program may have a law enforcement background, but that is not necessarily a qualifying factor for this position.
Follow-up, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. And that's what I thought, and that's why I'm asking. Well, I've got good news for you. And as Chair Moeller will tell you, my holy campaign this year is against fiscal notes and some of the outrageous assumptions that are being made in these fiscal notes and part of the funding problems that come up with this. I'm here to offer you a hope, and I'm here to offer you an answer that makes this fiscal note at best ridiculous. This is now going to be a crime. This will be investigated by police agencies or law enforcement agencies throughout the state. You will not be doing the investigations more than getting the file and doing a follow-up. The hard work is going to be done by people like this detective here that have already done it, but they didn't have a place to file a charge for this particular thing. So this bill solves two problems for you. So all these cases that you had to look at, you won't have to, and now we'll get some good protection. So for this reason, I just like to call out that the note with its high number is ridiculous, and it interesting, you know, the assumption that they made that the cases that we will have indicate that this is really needed. Because if the cases that you cite that you assume that you'll have to investigate, that you won't have to investigate anymore because people like the detective here will take care of that for you. And it also points out that there's a huge problem there that needs to be fixed. So I don't know what we can do about the fiscal note. I would ask for a review on that, but I think this bill with the amendment are very important. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vaughn. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again to Ms. Lopresto for sharing your story yet again. And I think, as you pointed out in your testimony, how many people have come forward and shared their own stories, and we all know someone, right? And like many brave survivors who come to the Capitol and share their stories in order to close gaps in the law, can't impact your case, but it makes it better for the next people and hopefully prevents some further assault. So thank you for that. It's very important. It's also important to believe victims and survivors at all levels, or anyone who is in a position of authority or in a position of power. We need to believe those victims. I did just want to make a quick comment about the fiscal note, and there is an impact, pretty minor, to the public safety budget. I'll just note that this is also included in the public safety finance package that we do have coming forward as well. I hope this committee considers that as a package in addition to this bill. Thank you,
Representative Kreshia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Lopresto, if you come back up to the table. You don't ever have to take a back seat again in your life. So, first of all, to the testifier, I want to thank you. Let you know that you alone have had more impact on this issue and going forward than probably any of the other legislators. So, thank you for that and your courage. Quickly on the note itself, as Chair Novotny and Chair Joachim and Chair Mueller pointed out, the fiscal note alone does demonstrate the need for this. And if what I'm hearing is that the fiscal note is a starting place and that we can find other ways to save on this, and if we can bring that cost down, then I think we're achieving what we need to in this committee. According to MDE, they'll need 7 more staff, at least 5 for investigations, and it sounds like that can be handled. But it does speak to the prevalence of these cases and increased investigations. Normally, I would look at this on how we can reprioritize funding inside MDE's budget. But with the caseload alone from these incidents and these groomings, I would urge support for this additional targeted funding for MDE, with the caveat that if we can find some of those savings through the reprioritization and the new possibilities that Chair Novotny put together, I think that would be great. And I believe that as we continue to look at this in future, education finance chairs can continue to set these priorities based on MDE, based on this as a standard and others. So I want to thank you, and to the investigator, thank you very much for coming forward. And I would support the bill.
Thank you. Representative Joachim, again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Co-Chair Kreshia covered it, too, that these investigations run parallel with what's happening in the criminal sector and have to do with licensing and what happens at a school. So I would agree with Co-Chair Kreshia that this should be additional funding, not expected to be absorbed by the agency.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bennett and Hannah. You know, Representative Bennett, you know that I have taken an experience of my own from abuse and made a change. You are making a change, both of you. You are going to change this for the future students who may go through this. And you never really expect to dig into your life and pull it forward and expose it to the world. But you're making a difference. So thank you so much for doing this. This is very brave.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Any final remarks, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Good discussion. I think this is a very important bill. There is funding, obviously, involved, which, as we know, as was mentioned, the working with the other body, things can change, and we can hone this into the bill that comes before, you know, finally before our body. But I want to say a special thanks to Hannah and Chad. The work's not done yet, but we're making good progress. And without them, really, this wouldn't be. And I appreciate I can be a part of this because it just appalls me that, you know, a generation ago I experienced this, and yet now we have young people still experiencing it. And I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten from the public expressing thanks for the bill and also saying, hey, my child was groomed as well. So it's important. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your work on this, Representative Bennett. Thank you for bringing the bill to us. The motion, members, is to move House File 3589 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is on the way. Next up is House File 3393, Representative Igo. Representative Igo, you can move your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
yes,
sorry.
I'd like to move the...
Better move the bill first.
Yeah. If I can move House File 3393, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The bill is before us. Now the amendment.
Yes, so before I present the bill, I'd like to put this A3 amendment on. I'll explain what it does and then go into the bill if that's all right. So I'd like to move the A3 amendment to House File 3393.
Go ahead and explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A3 amendment is the process of kind of like a dynamic collaboration between DEED and the USW as we were trying to make sure that the language in the bill was going to cover workers that were affected up in Minnesota's Iron Range at the Hiptech mine. There was some layoffs that were brought to my attention as I was working on the bill in preparation for the layoffs that occurred on February 1st. And through collaboration with the union and with the state, we finally came up with this amendment that's going to clean up the language to make sure that no one gets left behind.
Thank you. Question to the amendment, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Igo, thanks for the conversation we've had about the bill and the amendment. One thing that we didn't address in our conversations was the change at line 1.111. So I understand the amendment goes back in time a bit to capture a few more of those workers, as you referenced. But line 1.11, I just hadn't caught this when you and I spoke before, that the time period that sort of pulls in employees looks at actions taken by an employer under the amendment would be March 15, 2025, June 16, 2025. The original bill was January to March of 2026, and you and I just hadn't talked about that. Could you explain? Because that seems like that would affect all the workers, not just those additional 19.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that question, so the reason we had to adjust that line, and the folks from DEED are here, if we can confirm this if you'd like, but 110, 111 are focusing on that percentage for the layoff. The reason we sent that number back to March 15th to June 16th and adjusted the percentage to 40% is so then it then covers everybody. If we would have kept that date, in fact, it wouldn't have been 50% of the workforce. So that was one of the numbers that we had to work on for quite a long time to make sure we had the right percentage in effect.
I guess follow-up, Representative Igo. I'm Representative Pinto, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Igo, I guess what confuses me, though, is that you've now lost the eligibility in between June and March of 2026. Was that just an error in the first place? Because, like, the year has actually changed. It's not that it expanded the time period. It actually just shifts to a completely different year. So I'm still a little confused by that point. And maybe we do need DEED's assistance.
Are you going to phone a friend, Representative Igo?
I'm going to phone a friend. DEED is with us today.
Okay.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, name's Evan Rowe, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So 1.11 is essentially trying to ensure that we are selecting the correct employer in this case, right? So the challenge with the 2026 language was the employer in question had not had not laid off 50% of their workforce in 2026. That issue had occurred in 2025. So this is essentially making sure that the benefits are targeted to the correct employers that have had that situation come up.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's all.
Thank you, Representative Kento. Any other questions to the amendment? If not, we'll go ahead. All those in favor of to the amendment? Representative.
Aye.
All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Your bill is amended. Would you like to make some remarks about the bill overall before I go to questions?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief because the amendment kind of explained it. So going into session, members, on February 1st of this year, myself along with the range delegation were notified that there was going to be another 45 layoffs at the Hibtac mine, which is in the seat of my district. Members know from our discussions last year that the range is going through a hard time with now this layoffs climbing us almost to 700 layoffs in the mining industry up on Minnesota's Iron Range. This chamber, this body as a whole, has always stepped in the past to offer that unemployment extension to give these men and women who work very specialized jobs the opportunity to hold on for these mines to come back open. We have some good news on the horizon. We have Mesabi Metallics that is hopefully going to be opening soon in the coming weeks and months on the range, which will be the first new mine in 50 years, which is hopefully going to offer promise to these men and women that were laid off. But in that time, we need to make sure they can get along and stay here, because here's the problem. When the range loses people, we lose people, and they don't come back. They'll find new jobs in other states. They'll find new opportunities. These unemployment extensions are critical to keeping our communities whole, and something that I've encouraged members before, and a lot of members of this committee being in chairmanship roles, you've been to the range, and you've seen how tightly knit our communities are, that when there is a layoff, families don't go about this alone. Right? It's the churches, it's the schools, it's the businesses that are looking after their communities. And this is just the state coming in to say, we support that and we support our miners and we're going to support keeping this legacy industry of Minnesota intact. So I really want to thank the Hibtac Union President, Chris Johnson, for his collaboration with me, along with the USW staff rep, John Arbogast, along with Deed. Again, we were working back and forth for weeks to get this amendment in mind. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill to the committee today.
Thank you. To the bill as amended, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Igo, I don't have a problem supporting the families. What I do have some concern about, and it's something I think we need to look at for the long term, this appears to me to be a business model of the mining company. They bring the employees in, they use them for when they need them, and so it's really just-in-time employment, and then the state is expected to subsidize their business by providing this four-year loan, which is what it will be before they pay back the UI benefits that they will be receiving. So it's an interest-free loan for the company, and their business model isn't one that protects the miners or protects the families. So I think in the long term, I would like to see a way that we can give those families some consistency and some stability without them feeling like it's a panic situation, right? That's not good for their long-term health. It's not good for the long-term stability of the region. So I would really like for us to try to find a way to maybe adjust the business model of this particular company going forward, and maybe that's something we could work on together with Deed to see how do we do this. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. I just remind members that this is the Ways and Means Committee, and yep, we don't need to re-argue the bills. Representative Govans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm glad that Representative Claiborne talked about how this appears to be a business model of these particular corporations. And I guess I'll just say, it's hard for me to sit here when my community has just, many of our communities here have gone through a really unprecedented, exogenous economic shock that came from outside that we had no way of anticipating. and that has just left our economic corridors devastated, you know, families behind on rent and utilities. And, you know, it's really an unanticipated economic shock, and it feels like we will move heaven and earth to intervene when some people experience unprecedented economic shock or even precedented economic impacts. And in other communities, we can't come together in the same way to intervene for those Minnesotans who have really been through something, you know, that is just the magnitude of which is hard to communicate. So, you know, like, I have a heart for all, you know, people who are trying to make ends meet across the state of Minnesota. And so this is not to say anything about those miners whose economic reality is really being shook, and who, you know, are at the whim again of these multinational mining companies. This is not about saying anything about them, because I do believe that they deserve the state to intervene and fight for them, but so do the other Minnesotans across the state who have experienced real profound economic hardship in the last few months. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a quick question for the department in regards to the fiscal note 1.577.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question is, we're looking at the cost to the UI trust fund, not the general fund. And the question is, I've been hearing that this is cost neutral to some impact. But if you look at the way the calculation for the experience rating is done, we look back 3 years, which is 48 months. And so this portion of the fund is going to impact across the board. So it's more of a socialized process. Can you help us understand, because the employer here is not a reimbursing employer, that we will be collecting the entire amount?
Sure. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr. So the way that the experience rate mechanism works for non-reimbursing employers, so the, you know, tax-paying employers is the term in the law. You're correct that it is done on a look-back window. So an enterprise's tax rate is based on their experience with the UI program over a period of 4 years. That is meant to avoid having the impact of a layoff event spike a particular experience rate right away. It's meant to help spread the impact of such a rate as may occur during economic downturns and the like. So, you know, the design of the mechanism is such that it gets smoothed out over time. Now, over time, the experience rate, you know, will then be higher in the couple of years of that look back period, because that, you know, that look back window still is pulling in that experience data from the previous period. But you're correct that it wouldn't all hit in year one. Again, that is somewhat by design, because the UI trust fund is meant to help individual businesses maintain that.
A follow-up, Representative Norm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that effect, I think I will support workers when they're laid off at no fault of their own, but this cost will hit the UI trust fund, which I think right now there's also an additional assessment to the employers because of the we're not in a position whereby we're in a good shape in total. So this is not just impacting the industries who are going to be, you know, getting the benefit right now. It's going to hit all the employers. Just wanted to make that note. Thank you so much, Mr. Chen, members.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the comments of my colleagues about this bill, and I guess I'd urge all of my colleagues to support the bill in supporting workers and communities, and I would also urge all of my colleagues to support workers and communities experiencing economic devastation in other ways as well. And I would hope that the principle that we're following and supporting this would be applied to other communities as well, and I'll be looking forward to that support in the remainder of session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any final remarks, Representative Igo?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the discussion today. special thanks to Chair Baker, Chair Pentel. Thank you for hearing this bill on the first day of your guys' committee so we could start moving and working on this issue. You know, again, there's good news coming on the range, but when it hits hard, it hits hard. And this is the job of the delegation to carry these bills, to tell our story, and work together to get solution for our families and our workers across the region. And I just want to close with an old tale that I heard when I was door knocking years ago about these issues, is that even when the times try to crush us on the Iron Range, we still turn to steel. So thank you, members, for your support.
Thank you. The motion, members, is that House File 3393 be passed as amended to the General Register. I'm requesting a roll call. We will take the roll.
Chair Torkelson.
Aye.
Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scott.
Aye.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Backer.
Aye.
Representative Baker.
Aye.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heintzman.
Aye.
Representative Igo.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Kresha.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Aye.
Representative Swidzinski.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative West.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
Thank you. The vote being unanimous, the bill passes as amended. You're on your way to the General Register.
Thank you, members.
Next up, we have House File 3785, Representative DePell.
I was just gone.
Representative DePell, an amendment's being handed out. Will you please address the amendment? I assume it's yours.
It is, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment is a technical amendment making sure the DNR can post signs with appropriated money that either exists or is generated by the license fees.
Thank you. I will move the DePell Amendment A11 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Wait, aye.
We apparently have a pickup. I'm going to rephrase that.
I know, right?
We'll turn to fiscal staff for a explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and apologies for the last minute nature of this, but the fiscal note references for the Department of Natural Resources both a revenue and a cost. So the cost would be $30,000, and it is not to the general fund. It is a special revenue fund. And so they would require an appropriation of $30,000, and then it would be more than offset by the revenue of $32,000. The agency does not have the ability to access any of that revenue without a direct appropriation. So that's why the appropriation in this amendment is necessary.
Thank you. Any questions regarding the amendment? Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, appreciate the explanation there. I mean, this is a bill, and we've had conversations about this on the side. This is a bill that we know needs some more work. And Representative DePell, we've had a conversation, and my understanding is you are committed to making sure we do what we need to do before this bill hits the floor. Is that correct?
Representative DePell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Co-Chair Frazier, that is correct.
All right. And I just think this amendment shows that we've still got a little bit of work to do, but we'll make sure we get it done.
And thank you, Representative Frazier, and thank you, Representative DePell. So I will try again to pass the amendment. Sorry to rush you folks. Representative Scott, to the amendment? No. Okay. I will move the A11 amendment to House File 3785. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The bill is amended. To your bill, Representative Appel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill addresses specific concerns brought both by my constituent and many others, addressed by DPS as well, and a multitude of other layers, whether it be insurance companies and law enforcement, of how to address the issue of different classifications of electric bikes, e-bikes, and electric motorcycles. And currently, there isn't a good classification for an electric motorcycle. So an individual could be driving an electric motorcycle, get into an accident like happened to a constituent of mine, cause severe injury to that individual, and there isn't clarity for law enforcement to be able to either define that that was a motorcycle, that it only belonged on a public right-of-way, and what are the ramifications to the individual that was injured? How are they made whole? Through insurance or medical expenses and all the other layers that come in these very tragic incidences. And so what this bill does is it addresses the electric bicycle classification and the electric motorcycle classification, and it clarifies that for all parties involved.
Thank you. To the bill, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few friends that are Phi-Ed teachers, right? And every time they see one of these motorized bicycles, they're like cringy. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, we need to have people actually riding real bicycles and getting exercise. So just wondered if that was a stakeholder group you talked to, Representative DePell. And I say it partially facetiously because I know these things are out there and a lot of people are enjoying them. And I know you can do a combination of actually really pedaling and then motorizing it too. But the PE teachers that I know in my life are not happy about, you know, these bicycles that are electric. So,
Any response, Representative DePell?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, the positive thing that I've seen is many people getting out that might not have otherwise. And that's, I think, the net benefit of something like this. We've seen an 800% increase of their both usage and, unfortunately, accidents on them over the last couple of years. And so I think this is fitting.
Representative Iwaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative DePell. I know you and Representative Ream have worked on this. And I just have to say, too, my bike is my happy place, but before I had my knee replacement in December, I was really curtailed, and that's why I got an electric bike. And I'm kind of thinking of all our seniors and folks that have disabilities that, you're right, it enables them to get out. So we do have a lot of these in the market right now, and I hope part of what you're working out is looking at, you know, you really dropped the weight limit a lot and the speed that is now a lot of bikes that are in our stores and on our streets would not qualify for anymore. And I think those are a little low, especially when it comes to the 20 miles per hour, which I never usually get up to, but there's a little turbo that you can to try to pass somebody or get out of the way of something. These bikes are also heavy, especially if families are using them as commuter bikes, like one of our own representatives does, when you add the addition of being able to carry children on and need that electric assist. So I hope that's what you're looking at when you do start working on this bill, because I hate to see all of our bicycle dealers out there have to get rid of more than half their stock because of something we passed up here. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative DePell, I appreciate the work that you put into this. You identified a problem within your community and realized quickly as maybe a freshman representative how much work it takes to satisfy the concerns of many different stakeholders. But just out this weekend, I was out on walking on a trail, and I reflect back on the video that your constituent showed and getting run over from the back by somebody. And there was groups of kids out on bikes this weekend on the paths.
somebody on a rather fast one. I don't know exactly which classification it was, but they were going pretty quick and came up behind me, and luckily there was plenty of room on the path. But the importance of your bill and why this is such good work is that this is emerging technology, kind of emerging tools for transportation that people are using, and by establishing better classification, it allows for local communities to better educate the public, for parents and families to better educate their children on the safety of it. And so that's why this is, it might seem like it's not really, monumental bill, but it really is, helps families and communities be safer and enjoy the outdoors. So I really appreciate the work that you've done, and I know it wasn't easy.
Closing remarks, Representative Pell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate your support on the bill as we continue to move forward, and I hear all your concerns. Thank you.
The motion is that House File 3795 be referred to... I'll try again. The motion is that House File 3785 be referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way, Representative Pell. Next up, we have House File 856. Senate File 856. Thank you. We have co-authors here. I realize it's a little bit unusual, but I know that we've been working on this bill from both sides. There were a couple of bills at one time, and now we've landed on this one. Before we go to the bill, I'm actually going to go directly to fiscal, if that's okay. I'm taking her by surprise, as usual. Sorry about that.
No problem, Mr. Chair. I like to talk in committee. Members and Mr. Chair, this bill, it is a little unusual. In your packets, you have a fiscal note that is not exactly written to this bill, but it is a fiscal note that has a lot of good information. And I believe the LBO, the Legislative Budget Office, is here. And they, if the chair and the committee would like, I think they are prepared to speak to the fiscal note. They also have a one-page summary document that is a little bit easier to digest than reading through the entire fiscal note. And so they can sort of speak to the what's in this fiscal note and how that differs from the bill language that is in front of the committee.
Thank you. It looks like they're very ready. Whoever wants to go first, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your explanation of the fiscal note.
Excuse me. Chair Tolkien, Chair Frazier, members of the committee. My name is Christian Larson. I'm director of the Legislative Budget Office. As Emily said, I apologize, Ms. Adrian said, there's a high-level summary spreadsheet provided for you in your packets, and there's also the fiscal note. And so I'll walk through the kind of all of the other agencies that are in the fiscal note, but before that, I'll have Mr. Enders from our office read through the specific portion for the new Office of the Inspector General. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Enders now.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Torkelson and members. For the record, my name is Joel Enders with the Legislative Budget Office. I'll briefly go through the Office of Inspector General fiscal note and then turn things over to Director Larson to cover the other agencies on the consolidated note. On page 6, the OIG fiscal note estimates costs of $1.785 million in fiscal year 2027 and approximately $7 million in fiscal year 2028 and ongoing. The assumptions that support the OIG estimate begin on page 9. Total staffing is assumed at 38 FTE based on the duties specified in Article 1, Section 6, and conversations with the bill author, nonpartisan legislative staff, and agency staff. The staffing level would allow the OIG to operate independently and conduct multiple investigations and evaluations annually. The exact number depending on the subject scope and complexity of the investigations. Based on OLA output and reports produced by OIGs in other states, the proposed OIG could produce 5 to 8 external program evaluations and 20 to 25 internal investigation reports annually, although output will likely vary depending on investigation workloads, the types of investigations that are carried out, case complexity, and the depth of evaluation. Also note that the 38 FTE count includes 13 staff that are transferred from the Department of Education as specified in bill language. Also note that in fiscal years 27 and 28, the Department of Administration will provide implementation support, such as project management, hiring, procurement, office setup, and accounting to help the OIG get up and running. These costs are shown separately on the Department of Administration's note. So with that, I'll briefly run through an assumed timeline, much of which is specified in bill language and incorporated into fiscal note assumptions, which again start on page 9. So in FY26, the Inspector General Advisory Commission is created when the bill is enacted. In early FY27, that is by August 1st, commission members have to be appointed. By January 1st of 2027, the commission must recommend an inspector general. And by February 1st, the governor must appoint an inspector general. At the same time, the Department of Administration identifies and secures lease space with sufficient time for office design and build out. Between February 1st and May 1st, the inspector general, with the assistance of the Department of Administration, hires core staff such as a human resource director, general counsel, staff attorney, and an IT director. And then starting in FY28, 13 Department of Education staff are transferred to the OIG, and additional OIG staff are hired to fill out the office. Depending on job market conditions, it could take most of fiscal year 28 to fully staff the office. And then I would note that the law enforcement agency defined in bill language is created at the discretion of the future inspector general. So as such, the fiscal note discusses possible costs to establish a law enforcement agency on page 10, but a timeline is not assumed and these costs are not shown in fiscal note tables. So with that, I'll turn it over to Director Larson.
Director Larson.
Chair Tolkison, Chair Frazier, and members. Again, as Mr. Andrew walked through the Office of the Inspector General portion of the fiscal note, I'll walk through the rest of it. And so in that handout you have, it's kind of broken down into two pieces, the office setup and operations, and then there's agency interactions with the OIG, just other agency interactions that aren't the kind of official rollout of that Office of the Inspector General. If we take the setup and operations, the Department of Administration is carrying $890,000 in FY27 and FY28 for 6 FTE. That's based on the experience of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. It supports hiring, policy and office structure development, procurement, office setup, administrative support, space identification, things of that nature. And I should have referenced that's on page 14 of the fiscal note. And if you flip to page 29 of the fiscal note, you'll see the Department of Education. And that's acknowledging the transfer of duties from the Department of Education's Office Inspector General to the new Office Inspector General. That's 13 FTE, so a decrease of $2.218 million starting in FY28 and moving forward from the Department of Education. So if we move on to interactions with the Office Inspector General, so for offices or agencies to support investigations, provide data, things of that nature, agencies respond in that capacity. If you look to page 21 of the fiscal note, see the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. They're assuming they'll need 5 FTE. They'll kind of build up that in FY27. They'll be at 5 FTE by FY28 and moving forward. That's $465,000 in FY27 and $620,000 in FY28 and beyond. And again, that's to need for increased legal counsel, facilitate data requests, investigative collaboration, things of that nature. On page 37 of the fiscal note, see the Department of Health. They're assuming $499,000 starting at FY27 moving forward for 2.5 FTE. Again, associated with the need for legal counsel and review investigative investigatory collaboration, managing interactions with the federal WIC program and WIC reporting requirements in the bill. On page 41, Department of Human Services assumes $2.721 million in FY27 and $3.2 million in FY28 and beyond. For 21 FTE in 2027 and 28 FTE in 2028 and beyond, this is assumed that there's increased tips and expectations to investigate. They would expand their basic go to investigative teams within the DHS OIG within these assumptions, increased need for legal counsel, associated with memorandums of understanding and data sharing, both with the new Office of Inspector General, along with interactions with the federal offices and the BCA. The need staff to respond to data requests, and there's some associated administration with that level of FTE increase. On page 45, you have the Department of Labor and Industry. They're assuming $27,000 per year starting at FY27, coming out of the Worker Compensation Fund, and that is to interact with investigations of Department of Labor and Industry programs. And then on page 50, you have the legislature, and they're carrying $29,000 in FY27 and $7,000 thereafter to support the Legislative Investigator General Advisory Commission. Just a couple of notes that we made as we reviewed this note. As Mr. Andrews has stated, the fiscal note for the Office of Inspector General assumes that the Inspector General won't be hired until February of 2027, and so late into 2027, there'll be some staffing time required to get the Office of Inspector General up and running, and so to what extent those agencies will have to interact with the Office of Inspector General in FY27 or that first year of operations is, I think, to be determined, and I'm not known at this time. Also, what's included in the fiscal note are the agencies identified specifically in the bill. There's likely other fiscal impacts for agencies to interact with the future Office of the Inspector General. As other agencies had stated, data sharing, things of that nature, they're just not included in the fiscal note to facilitate the processing of the fiscal note. And finally, there is a large increase in Department of Human Services estimates of the FTE from the previous estimate in this fiscal note to the current one. And so that's just something we noted, but the agency, we work with the agency, talk to the agency about those estimates, and so those are included in this current fiscal note. And from there, we're happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you for those presentations. Members, I should have said this earlier. The intention with this bill is not to pass it out today, but because of the nature of this issue and the complications of the fiscal note, I wanted to get the fiscal note before us so that you can all digest that between now and when we actually vote on the bill. So if you have detailed questions, I suggest you take them offline. If there's any general questions regarding the fiscal note, I'd be happy to take those now. I don't see any. I do see one. Schumacher, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation there. Just a question on the Department of Human Services piece. You touched on it lightly there, but the fiscal note says that the LBO was unable to verify for reasonableness or accuracy the information provided by the department there. That was from the April 1st note. Has there been updates from the department to help you address that, or are those still in question?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, we still haven't. The agency has been in contact with us and shared information about the increased number of investigation and tips and things like that have come over the last 12 months. And that's really the basis for their assumption of what they need for in this fiscal note. The LBO has concerns with that level of estimate in terms of what's really required of agencies and what investigations would happen at the agency level versus what happened in the new Office of Inspector General. But again, it's a new office. It's the interactions between the agency and the office are not fully defined at this time, and so I would say the LBO isn't confident that we can fully validate that, but we also certainly can't say that's not the case.
Okay. Thank you, follow up, Representative Schumacher?
Nope, thank you.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are Representative Norris and Representative Anderson going to speak to the bill?
Okay. Yes, they are.
Then maybe I'll wait until.
All right, any other questions regarding the fiscal note? Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation. We'll bring the authors back to the table. If you want to make a brief presentation about your ongoing deliberations and any potential changes that you are
proposing at this time that you will be discussing between now and the time the bill actually is up for a vote. I would take those remarks. Please keep them brief. Who would like to go first?
I'll go first, Chair Torkelson. Thank you. And thank you to the members of the committee, and thank you for Representative Anderson for being here as well. I think it shows the collaborative nature of this process since really the start of last year when we've been working in a bipartisan fashion with both members of the House and the Senate to try to come to a resolution on this bill. We have been able to get through a number of issues that we've worked through. You know, I think as you even mentioned, Chair Torkelson, we started with two different bills in the House, and we're now we've been able to coalesce around one bill. We have a few remaining sticking points that we're working diligently to resolve. There's productive conversations happening between both the House and the Senate, DFLers and Republicans. This is a bill that is really important to the people of Minnesota. We want to make sure that it is effective, that it's ready to do the job on day one, and that's why I, you know, can speak at least for myself that I've been so committed to digging into the details of this bill, making sure that questions are resolved, that we're taking a close look at some of these remaining sticking points so that we do have a bill that Minnesotans can be proud of, and importantly, that is ready to do the critically important work we expect it to do when it gets implemented.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'll just echo those feelings. We are very, very close on this. There are a few minor things that we're negotiating and discussing, and we hope to be able to bring this back to you shortly as a done deal. So.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate the being recognized. So Representative Norris, I have two questions for you. One, we have been talking about having the law enforcement agency either within the OIG or externally, external. So if it is my understanding, and please correct me if you want to, so if we put law enforcement inside the OIG, it will cost us about $12.5 million per year. If we leave the BCA intact, this would be work that they would already be doing within the BCA. Is that correct?
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson and Chair Claiborne, yes, that is my understanding.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Claiborne.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so today we're doing the withholding of payment bill on the floor. And in preparing for that bill, I noticed how many times DHS has used this temporary withholding, which means there could be a credible allegation of fraud. Under this bill as it's written, that would automatically have to be referred to the OIG if I understand the bill correctly. So DHS has used it already. Now, keep in mind, it went into effect in 2025. They've used it 500 times, and DCYF has used it 40 times. So when I'm looking at the assumptions in the fiscal note about the number of staff that would have to be hired between DHS and the OIG, I think this is concerning that they're only looking at 5 FTE for family, children, youth, and family. And then I think the human services, we may need to really look at that if it's 500 claims and we're doing duplicative work in both the agency and in the OIG. The other piece that I have grave concern about is the Department of Education is the staffing for the OIG office is coming out of the Department of Education, and that would be 13 staff members. So if we take, if best practices, as we have learned and heard through the long period of time that we have been working on this bill, best practices is that those 13 staff would stay in agency, close to the work that they're doing. And then the OIG would need to hire additional staff. So if we take that $2.2 million and add it to the cost of the $7 million per year, I'm talking per year, we see that it's really $9.2 million to adequately staff the OIG in addition to the law enforcement of 12.5 per year and the additional employees that we might need. So I think as we look at this fiscal note and as we look at the bill, we need to be really clear-eyed about what we're asking this agency to do. And I think we have to be really clear-eyed about the stomach that we have for truly funding this office. If we're going to do it, I want it to be done properly, as I know you do as well. So I think when we're looking at 38 to 40 million, or we're looking at 40 to 50 or 60 million, we need to be really clear with the people of Minnesota about what this office is going to cost and the important work we're asking them to do. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Anderson, kind of your general perspective on this issues that has been presented in these two questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to take Mark Cortman's advice and be very nice. So whether the law enforcement piece is within the OIG, which it has to be, or whether it is some outside entity that's doing it, it is still there are still additional people needed for additional prosecutions. So this isn't a zero, you know. Okay. The speculation on the 12 is just speculation. We don't know. I've talked to some folks, and this is, you know, they don't need 30 law enforcement people for this agency, and that's what that number gets. So it's, you know, it's pure, you know, that can be designed by, frankly, future legislatures too. We can, the bill as it's set up is that the law enforcement piece is an optional down the, essentially, but the OIG can choose that. This is going to not take effect until February of next year, and the entire budget process is going to start over next spring. So I want to just point that out. But the law enforcement piece within the OIG is the norm across the country. That's how it's done, and it is key to this bill. And this is the negotiated piece between House File 1 and Senate File 856, was that this would be the law enforcement piece would be here. And that's how we got to this so far. That is how the Senate got to a bipartisan agreement, a 60-7 vote. And I hope that we can get the same thing here in the House. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just would be to Rep. Norris, just, you know, kind of just on the outside looking in, you mentioned sticking points a couple times. Do you have any specifics of what those sticking points are?
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson and Representative Swierczynski, yeah, I can highlight a couple of them. I guess, you know, one of the main sticking points is why we would spend up to $12.5 million per year in taxpayer dollars to duplicate work that the BCA is already doing. Another one would be, you know, why we would go against federal best practice and pull the Minnesota Department of Education Inspector General's office out of MDE moving forward. I think we want to talk about how we will make sure that this office has the resources necessary to do the job well. And then I think we also need to talk about how do we make sure there's appropriate oversight to ensure this office is operating in a professional manner while still maintaining the really important independence of this office.
Representative Anderson, would you care to comment on any of those points?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the oversight piece that Representative Norris, if I'm not correct, is just specifying exactly who is going to be doing the review. Is that the only piece of that?
That's we all don't need to negotiate told. It right here. Just
as a working group. That is very simple to fix. The MDE piece, first of all, I think, on the House Education Committee when that was actually put into place. And most of the time, MDE has not had an OIG in that office. It's a very new. Most entities, you know, states out there don't have OIGs within education departments. And frankly, if we had in place a statewide OIG, we would have never had Feeding Our Future. Never. It would have not happened. And we have to have that independent oversight over these public programs. We cannot have the agencies policing themselves, or we're going to lose more and more dollars. Regarding the law enforcement piece, you know, the three of the caucuses are absolutely set on this and have been since the beginning. And again, this is how we got to agreement between House File 1 and Senate File 856. So, you know, at some point there needs to be a decision made by the fourth caucus as to whether they're going to support the bill. So,
thank you. Representative Iwaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I'm talking so much in committee, but so many of these bills need to be talked about a little bit more, and I appreciate the latitude. I want to just thank both of you for working so hard on this. I know there's been some sticking points, but, you know, as bills move through committee process and they usually get worked out, this is kind of feels like it's getting rushed a little bit this year. And we don't always think the Senate does the best things. So the other body, sorry about that. I'm glad that you're working out the sticking points, but I have to make a pitch. The reason why we put an Office of Inspector General, MDE, is many layered. But one of those layers is the second largest budget in the state. And the reason why we look different than other states, we're in the top 10 in the country of how much money we spend in our general fund towards our K-12 system. So we're unique in that 60 to 65% of a district's budget comes directly from the state versus 60% coming from property taxpayers. So that is unique in and of itself. And I heard the LBO mention and that the national standard is to keep the subject matter experts within the agencies to do, you know, the groundwork, like you would with a detective doing the groundwork to make sure that you're then reporting to the higher-ups. Those subject matter experts become subject matter experts because they're within the field. They're within MDE. You pull those out and put them in OIG, you're going to end up having them severed to the where they will not be having those multiple conversations they need to have with districts across the state, all 331 of them, 300 and some charter schools. Those relationships are built over time. Pulling those folks out of MDE does not make sense, especially since the LBO themselves said, you know, if they don't have the subject matter expert at OIG, which over time they won't anymore, that they're going to have to hire more people to figure that out. So it would be more prudent to keep the Inspector General office intact at MDE because of not just that subject matter expert, but because it's the second largest part of our state budget. And because since we've stood up that office, there's been 412 complaints received with 178 already closed, 234 cases under investigation, 66 under full investigations. 21 of those investigations, there was a lot of collaboration between law enforcement and BCA. There were already 20 temporary sanctions imposed, which helped the program program savings of $1.1 million. They've recovered over money in recovery funds. And it just makes sense to make sure that MDE stays within, the OIG stays within that expert, because just like the one in DHS and DCYF, our Department of Education also receives federal funds. We receive federal funds for special education, and we receive federal funds, as you all know, for nutrition. So we have that federal interaction that should be taken over and watched in the agency, just like DHS and DCYF. So I'm glad this is still being discussed. I think it's really important. And with that, Mr. Chair, there was a question.
Representative Claiborne, a final quick remark.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The quick remark is I don't see in this fiscal note anything for Minute. If we are going to have an OIG office, we've seen in the governor's OIG bill that that's a $15 million cost. So we need to make sure that all of the IT needs are also met in this bill, and we are transparent about those costs as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Norris and Representative Anderson. We're going to cut it off at that point. We are done for today. We will be seeing this bill again right after you reach final agreement, which is going to happen very soon, I understand. Next, we have House File 4006 of Representative Warwas, if you come forward. Members, we're going to do what I think will be two fairly quick bills, and then we're going to jump to the CHA bill because we do have a number of folks here that are interested in that bill. Representative Warwas, House File 4006. Sorry, I'm
get ahead of myself. There are no amendments. The motion will be to move this bill to the general register. Please, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair. And I can see this is a very important committee, but as a first-timer, I also recognize you're neglected here. I brought fresh homemade cookies over there, and the pages are going to pass those out. Full disclosure, my wife made those, but I did do the dishes. So,
well, wait a minute.
To my
are
bill.
Are you fully qualified to do those dishes?
Let's talk about that offline, Mr. Chair.
All right.
House File 4006 is a simple bill, really, requested by St. Louis County to modify a prior appropriation for Phase 1 of the Progress Parkway project in the city of Eveleth. The original appropriation was for $6 million to design and construct Progress Parkway from Trunk Highway 53 to Trunk Highway 37, with an expiration date of June 30th, 2027. Phase 1 bids connected Trunk Highway 53 with the school and adding a roundabout that had been opened, and the project has come in under budget at $4.6 million. Those funds will be expended by the original June 30th, 2027 deadline. My request is for a time extension to June 30th, 2030, so that the remaining $1.4 million can be used on Phase 2 of this important safety and economic development project, which will complete the construction of a new alignment south to the Trunk Highway 37 intersection, and I would appreciate this committee's support for House File 4006.
Thank you. Representative Warwas, I believe there are actually no fiscal impacts to this bill. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I'm not sure why you're here, but here you are. Any questions for Representative Warwas? Seeing none.
Just a quick comment to my fellow ranger carrying this bill. This is a really big issue that we're going to fix, so appreciate the bill in front of us because we need Highway 53 to be safe for our East Rangers. Thank you.
Thank you. The motion is that House File 4006 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way. Representative Warwas will next move to Representative Olson with House File 4615.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Olson.
Since I'm a member of the committee, I guess I can move House File 4615. This bill has to do with enlisted soldiers and officers and their compensation for state active duty. Just to clear the record here, I'm a major in the United States Army Reserve, which is a different entity than the National Guard, so this has nothing to do with any pay that I would receive. But back in 1997, the state of Minnesota said your enlisted pay is almost too small for the portion of disruption to your life when you go on state active duty. And so they said if you're an E1 or an E2, an E3, you will be paid $130 for your state active duty. If you look, there's a chart that's been included in your packet. The previous money, if you were a private in 1997, you would have received something like $56 for your work. So not a lot of money. You'd get $56 for your housing allowance. You'd get $33 for your base pay, which means that you going on active duty in 1997 would have gotten you about $80-some dollars. And the state of Minnesota in 1997 said that's not quite enough. So we said $130 is the minimum amount of money that the state will pay for individuals who are activated for state active duty. Now, if you look, we'll fast forward nearly 30 years, and the base pay for soldiers has increased, but the state of Minnesota's minimum pay has not. So there isn't a single soldier who's put on state active duty who gets paid that $130. It now is the minimum. That's the floor. But an E1 makes more money than they do. So this is now it doesn't matter anymore. This bill, the legislation we currently have, doesn't matter one bit because no one's making that money. But what we really need to assume is that individuals who are activated under state active duty should get paid a rate that exceeds the value of what their daily pay would be. And so what this bill does is it ties it to a sergeant's pay, an E5's pay. So if you are an E1 through an E5 who's activated under state active duty, you would get paid as if you were an E5, as if you were a sergeant, which I think is wholly a necessary thing to do as we move forward with some of our state active duty activations. So if you look at the chart, if you are a private first class, you would receive under this new piece of legislation $186 for your day of work, which equals about $15 an hour for a 12-hour day of work for the state of Minnesota. So it's not quite a lot of money, but it's at least something, and I think it's right. And what we would do is we would tie it to the sergeant pay, which means we would not have to deal with this issue ever again in the state of Minnesota. We wouldn't have to come back 30 years from now and say our soldiers aren't getting paid enough for the work that they're doing for our state. With me, I have Lieutenant Colonel Lathman of the Minnesota National Guard. If you have any questions, you can direct that to him. But I think that I have potentially done a sufficient job of explaining this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. We'll turn to fiscal staff for remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the fiscal note shows that the estimated increase would be about $30,000 per year. The language is from the Senate bill, but it is the same as the House file. But this is a forecasted program, so it does not require an amendment. But if the funds are needed, they are automatically expended.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. With that, I don't see any other questions. Any final remarks, Representative Olson?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The motion is that House File 4615 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way, Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Next, we will move to House File 3919, the CHA bill. Welcome, Representative Cha.
Thank you.
I'm getting organized, so just hold on a minute. Thank you. The motion on House File 3919 is to move to the General Register. We do have one amendment, I believe, that we are going to discuss, and that is the A5 amendment. Representative Cha, will you please explain the A5 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair and Committee. A5 is to appropriate this funding to the from the general fund and then to also cancel appropriation from a previous year to an organization from the MBBA.
Any questions regarding the A5 amendment? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to add some of my oomph and influence on the acceptance of this amendment. Representative Cha and I spoke this morning. We thought this was the best way forward for this bill and the way we're funding it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Any other remarks or questions regarding the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment to House File 3919, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Your amendment is on to the bill, Representative Cha.
Yes, Chair. Before I start, can I have 2 minutes to acknowledge the veterans in the room?
Representative Cha, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, with me is the SGU veteran soldiers from the Secret War of Laos. Many of these gentlemen are over 70 years old, as you can see, but they're here today because they need your support, and they're here because this really matters to them. Thank you, Chair. Last year we passed House File 1845 to establish a task force. Over the interim, we met over 8 times with the SGU task force to come up with some recommendations that we could agree on. And so House File 3919 is that bill. And so this bill is to give limited benefits to these SGU veterans. And these are recommendations that came out of the SGU task force. And without further ado, I'm going to yield my time here to Mr. Kelly from the MDVA so we can get this bill moving. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members. John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So the bill before the committee today reflects the recommendations of the Special Guerrilla Unit Task Force that was convened by the department in the interim. The department was tasked with establishing a protocol and process for verification of these veteran service, and that is what's before the committee today. So there we've nested this process within the existing federal process for determining eligibility benefits. While this is creating a set of benefits for these SGU veterans, it is not opening up these veterans to all of Minnesota's veterans benefits. So there's a limited set of benefits here. Most significantly, the benefits for these veterans revolve around burial in state veteran cemetery and burial honors in a private cemetery or in a veteran cemetery. So the Department of Veterans Affairs for the United States Department of Veterans Affairs has a process where they determine burial eligibility, including for veterans of the Secret War in Laos. So our process in this bill is that these veterans will apply to the federal government for burial eligibility. They'll get that burial eligibility determination. They'll bring it to the department, and they'll be issued a certificate that says they are a verified SGU veteran, and they're eligible for the list of benefits that are in this bill. If there is a denial from the VA, they can appeal to the VA, and provide the VA will tell you what you're missing, what you need to come up with in order to get a favorable decision. If there is not a favorable decision from the VA, they have an opportunity in this bill to do a special consideration process to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. And so the Commissioner will evaluate the same application materials and everything, and also has the ability to ask for additional materials, and through that special consideration process can issue the eligibility document if they are deemed to be eligible SGU veterans. The one difference is if they receive the special consideration benefit or eligibility from the commissioner, they would not be eligible for burial in the state veteran cemetery, but they'd be eligible for all of the other benefits. So the fiscal note on the amendment that was just put on earlier will fund the department staffing the special consideration process. That process is going to go from enactment until the end of calendar year 2030, which largely mirrors the process that was in place during the Hmong Naturalization Act of 2000. And given the age of most of the applicants, we feel like we need to just kind of get this done, do these applications, and get this these benefits to these folks. We don't need to have an indefinite staff person doing this. So we thank the committee for its support for including the funding for the department, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. We'll turn to the fiscal staff for remarks regarding the fiscal note. Thank you, Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the amendment contains all of the appropriation changes, and the cancellation is an amount of $100,000 that would cancel from the general fund, so that would be a savings of one time. And then the appropriation is $59,000 in 2027 and then $141,000, both of which are from the general fund. And as was testified to, the $141,000 is just a one-time appropriation.
Thank you. Seeing no member questions, Representative Shaw, final remarks.
I do have a testifier. Is that, do you, can?
If you think it's absolutely necessary, Representative Shaw, otherwise I'd be happy to have closing remarks and move on. We have some more bills.
Sure, I understand. I recognize that. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for hearing this bill today. As you see, this bill is important to not only myself, but to the Hmong community. And every single Hmong person in the state of Minnesota is here because of the Secret of Laos. Six of your members in the House of Representatives, we are all refugees or children of the refugees of Hmong here. So thank you for hearing this bill. I hope that we can continue to work together to get this passed. I want to thank Chair Bliss, Chair Jay Zhang, and also Chair Kosnick and Tapke, and working with this, also with Vice Chair Olson. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. The motion is that House File 3919, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Representative Shaw, you're on your way to the General Register. Thank you all for being here today. We're going to move on to Representative Nash, House File 4591. Representative Nash, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move 4591 with the recommendation to the floor.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 4591 is the work for the ability to provide AMPRs with a small amount of funding in order for them to reduce their overall fiscal impact by going through a headcount reduction. This bill was heard in state government finance, was moved out unanimously And for those unfamiliar with AMPRs, I'll be very brief. If you've ever been in northern Minnesota and you got an AMPR alert or a tornado alert, or you've been in southern Minnesota and you got those same alerts, it's because of AMPRs. So I have been on various lakes, got those same alerts. Without them, we would not have gotten them. So I have a test fire here to talk briefly about the cost-cutting effort that's going on and that why it requires, as you see on lines 2.31, $165,000.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the president and CEO of AMPRs, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. We represent and support 17 different smaller community radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota. They go up as far north as Thief River Falls and Grand Marais, down to Winona, Mankato, and Austin, and just about everything in between. Very briefly, to clear up any confusion, we are not affiliated, nor do we receive funding from Minnesota Public Radio or Twin Cities Public Television stations. Collectively, we lost $3.5 million in federal funding. Some of those stations, that's as much as 50% of their operating budget. The cuts disproportionately impacted native stations and the stations in greater Minnesota. Some are in jeopardy of surviving. While we would love to ask for $3.5 million, we realize that is not realistic. So instead, we looked at a way to consolidate our expenses. So we are looking at hiring one FTE to do the work that many of the stations have between 0.1 and 0.2 FTE doing that work. These funds would be used to pay for software as well as the reduction in the headcount. We are also asking to reduce the grant qualifications from 2.0 to 1.5 FTE. Some of the stations are operating with 1.5 and they would not be eligible any longer. With that, Mr. Chair, I would ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just really briefly, Representative Nash, thank you for working on this. It's sad the impacts of some of the stuff we've seen in the bigger bills and the national politics, but Mr. Glazer and these radio stations are incredible and do great work all over the state, so I really want to thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this forward and working to help save these vital institutions. So thank you.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you. Just wanted to thank Representative Nash for bringing this forward. In addition to the some of the stations that he talked about, also my community is served by AMPR stations, by KFAI and KMOJ and KBEM, which is a jazz station out of North High School. And, you know, these are just really amazing community institutions that do all kinds of things for all kinds of people. So thank you.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Representative Nash.
Thank you.
The motion is that House File 3682, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
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 Sorry, my fault.
Yep, wrong bill.
I got my pages mixed up. We'll try again. I ask your forgiveness.
Yep.
Motion is that House File 4591 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. That bill is on its way. Now we're going to go back to the one that I really wanted to do, Representative Nash, to House File 3682, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move 3682 to come before the committee, and I do have an A2 amendment.
Please explain the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment would be the cost to effectuate the bill.
Any questions to the A2 amendment to House File 3682? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Your bill is amended to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3682, as amended, is another tool that we can put in the toolbox of administration as they're building out their grant risk assessment. It'll put another tool in the toolbox, much along the lines of a cybersecurity methodology called vendor risk management. Vendor risk management is effectively a numeric score that is attached to each question that might be a qualifier. for the grant to be received. Some of the things that might be received are based on what the department would list as criterion or internal controls, and the gist of the bill is going to be to provide a numeric ranking or numeric value for each of those, so that after someone submitted a request for a grant, the rating system could say of a total 100 points, if you fall below 50, we're going to automatically kick you out of qualification and say and encourage you to go back and try to prop up your score by making some internal control changes. The department then would say if you reach a score of 80 or whatever, it's up to them. I'm not being prescriptive in this bill at all. It would then say you're allowed to move on to the next phase of consideration. At no time does it immediately disqualify in totality, but this is another tool that we can put in the toolbox to say we want to make sure that we're vetting everything and that we're looking at everything as closely and with a scrutiny-based eye as possible. This works very well in the cybersecurity world, and it makes it so that that relationship between the state and a potential grantee is done with full information and a full view into their internal controls and their practices. And that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Question from Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. I guess my first question is, do you have a prescription of what some of these principles would be? And would that also be transparent to both the applicants and anyone else looking at this?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Agbaje. The questions would be something that I would expect would be listed as, I'll lean this way, you can lean that way, that it would be a listing of qualifications required to be in receipt of the grant, and it would be published. So there could be, I don't know, 200, 100 numbers of different things that they would know full well on the way into their request for the grant that these are things that are going to be looked at, and that the point values associated with each of them would be made very aware to them that you must receive or achieve a certain number of ranking points in order to automatically move on to the next level. There's no gotcha moment here. This is very transparent in my estimation, much like it is in the cybersecurity world when somebody chooses to do business with the state or another entity. You publish the list of requirements, and then you would say, well, of the 100 required valuations, you only got 60 and you need 75 or whatever that number is. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the clarification, Representative Nash. I mean, I think that that's helpful. I guess my only concern is as these requirements are being developed is that they don't become so onerous, particularly for a number of our grantees that are very close to community issues and problems. I mean, one of the things that I'm always mindful of as we continue to do these grants management updates and is that ability for capacity building for a lot of our organizations. I just want to make sure that, yes, we're being transparent with them about what they need to meet, and they should meet those guidelines, but I also want to make sure that we have opportunities for them to also build their capacity and develop their strength so they can meet those guidelines. So while I think that this bill does a lot, I hope that as more bills around this area come forward, that they keep that capacity building in mind for a lot of our grantees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cortez-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill forward. Frankly, I think that $71,000 is a steal for the impact that this could have on our grant process. And I think, you know, with Vice Chair Agbaje's comments in mind, I think that this is a really good step in the right direction to firm up that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Representative Nash.
Thank you.
Representative Nash renews his motion that House File 3682, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way. We have one more bill. Representative Freiberg, House File 4240. Representative Freiberg, I do not see any amendments to. There was an amendment, but it's not being offered, apparently. So to your bill, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. This proposal includes a series of election administration updates designed to improve efficiency and clarify procedures and reduce unnecessary costs. Of relevance to this committee is Section 9. We saw last year the number of special legislative elections is unpredictable. This can create budgeting hardships for counties and cities who haven't planned on having 2, 4, or 6 additional elections. So the Section 9 establishes a reimbursement process for counties and municipalities that incur costs administering state or federal special elections not currently held in conjunction with another state election. For this provision, the fiscal note shows a cost of $185,000 in the current biennium and $428,000 in the tails in cost to the Secretary of State to distribute to local governments for reimbursement after a special election. That's a brief summary of the bill. Nicole Freeman is here from the Office of the Secretary of State if there are any questions, and thank you for fitting this bill in.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Any questions for the author or the very capable testifier that is accompanying him? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Freiberg?
To quote Chair Nash, thank you.
The motion is that House File 4240 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way, Representative Freiberg. Representative Frazier, anything to tell us about the next meeting?
We will continue to move bills. We'll have that slate, so look out for the posting.
And we are meeting?
We are meeting Wednesday, 1 o'clock.
At
1 p.m.
Thank you, members. This meeting is adjourned.